This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is July 30th, 2009. This is another in the series with Judith Kornblatt, Professor of Slavic Languages and Literature and Senior Associate Dean of the Graduate School. Judith, we were into your research program at the last session, and we wanted to continue with some observations from you on, first of all, the interdisciplinary nature of your research and the program here, and then we have several other areas to get into.
Okay, I did want to emphasize how I have taken different paths in my research. Mm-hmm. The first book was on the Cossack hero in Russian literature, and it was, although it did some more cultural studies, it was pretty much a literary work. And the second book was a collection of essays on Russian religious thought, mm-hmm. which very consciously brought together historians and philosophers and theologians and literary experts. Experts in religion. First, there was a conference where we all gathered here on the shores of Lake Mendota, and then this book, which pretty much sort of began or formed the basis of the field in the United States, because no one really had been studying it. And now, with a former student, I'm hoping to put out another volume to show what has come of that, what's happened with that field over the past 15, 20 years. Mm-hmm. I did put together a conference in honor of my co-editor of that volume, who had been one of my professors. And so there are already several articles that we might use, and we're going to sort of pitch it as the continuation of this field to see where we are now. So that was a lot of fun, and just to see how different disciplines approach the same topic was a fascinating thing for me. So when I went to do my third book, some of it was serendipitous because I was taking my first sabbatical, mm-hmm. and my first and only sabbatical. And I think I talked about this in going to Russia, and Israel, and I tried to think of a topic that would be interesting for me to do there. And I had previously been interested in the relationship of Jewry and Russian Orthodoxy, and I had written about that in the work of Vladimir Solovyov, the philosopher that I study. And it occurred to me that I knew a number of Jews who had been baptized in the Orthodox Church. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, why don't I try and do a study of them? And so I made a foray really into a different discipline altogether, a different kind of work, where I did interviews with individuals, Jews who had been baptized in the church in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And it was a whole other kind of a world. So that was, and I had to read not only in history, which is something that people in literary studies often do, but sociology, anthropology, political science, and learn to use that vocabulary and learn what one does with an interview. So that was a very fascinating period of where I did very different kinds of interdisciplinary work. Then my last book we spoke about the Divine Sophia, which also is a combination of literary studies, religious studies, history, studies of mysticism. It also brought together a lot of different areas. And I realized how important it is to expand beyond not just your own body of work that you do, what you tend to have been trained in, but also the different ways in which you approach that body of work. And so I've I emphasize that a lot with my graduate students and try to get them not to get stuck in any particular approach to any body of work. So I found that to be very rewarding for myself, and I think very important for the continuation of scholarship.
Would you say that you advocate for interdisciplinary scholarship?
I definitely would say that. I also know that in an academy like ours, it's very difficult. You're rewarded for your disciplinary work.
Yes.
And often the interdisciplinary work is sort of on top of what it is that you're expected to do, both in terms of teaching and in terms of research. And often I found with publishing my books also that the press and also the readers that the manuscript is sent out to don't know necessarily how to market. They don't know what the audience is for a book that is interdisciplinary. And so I've had to position my books and contextualize them in a certain way to say they're for a number of different audiences. So that's also difficult. And I think as we move into service, I'll also talk about being in a number of different areas and how one tries to participate in all of those areas.
Judith, do you think among your heavy-duty colleagues that there is a sense that interdisciplinary work is lesser?
Yes. I think that it's not as true with the younger scholars, but certainly with the scholars trained in my generation, there is a loyalty to the discipline itself, mm-hmm. and there's a sense of kind of, you know, their feeling that you're watering it down mm-hmm. when you bring in other areas. And I also agree that in order to do good interdisciplinary work, you need to be very well grounded in at least one discipline. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't take away from you to learn the terminology and learn the approach of other disciplines, and it helps you see your own work in a broader framework. So, but yes, I think you are correct that there were a lot of faculty who pushed back at the Cluster Hire initiative here at UW because it was going to bring in these newfangled, fancy, schmancy new areas at the expense of the traditional departments that also needed new funds and new influx of new people, and that it could potentially bring in less serious scholarship of some kind. So, and there were also some programs here I know that felt I remember coming, for instance, from philosophy, that they're already inherently interdisciplinary. They already work as a cluster because there's a history of science and history of religion and history mm-hmm. of art and philosophy of science and mm-hmm. philosophy of art and philosophy of education, and that already they are working in that way, and therefore their department should get a cluster hire. whereas the cluster hires were seen in a very different way. There was also a sense in which the humanities were disadvantaged by the cluster hires. Here I'm moving into a slightly different area, if that's okay.
Although, it is, because I have some questions about the cluster hires.
So you want me to keep going in this
keep
way?
Going.
Okay.
Absolutely.
They were disadvantaged for a number of different reasons. And some of it had to do with the way in which humanists have traditionally done their research, which tends to be solitary research. And mm-hmm. when we understood interdisciplinary work, it was that the researcher, the scholar, him or herself, needed to go out and learn these other areas and bring it in. Whereas often when scientists talk about doing interdisciplinary work, it's creating a team of people, one physicist, one chemist, one biologist, and they work together on an interdisciplinary project. So it was a different way of, so really interdisciplinary work in the, or multidisciplinary work in the sciences is understood to be teamwork. Now teamwork is largely how scientists do their work anyway, mm-hmm. and that when they looked at the humanists, they said, well, that can't be good scholarship. Where's the team? That's just yourself. And so there was a way in which that was denigrated, that the sort of solitary scholarship was not as was not seen as the right kind of work. And I faced that when I first came to the graduate school, actually, and we'll talk to that about, you know, why do they do that? They should be working in teams. And so in some ways, I believe that there is a lot of advantage to working in teams, and the humanities are working more in that direction. But there's also a lot of advantage to doing the kind of work traditionally that humanists have done. So they, in that way, they were disadvantaged in the cluster hires. Also because I sat on some of the committees that chose the, or made recommendations about which proposals would be accepted. And when, and this will sound a little bitter, maybe, and it's also quite, it's, you know, very broad strokes, so I don't want you to think that, I think this is, you know, true in every case, because it isn't. But on the committee, I found that the humanists and some of the social scientists would say, well, I don't really understand the science here, but I'll, you know, I will cede to the scientists in the room whether this is good science or not. And, you know, but I can judge whether the proposal is put together, whether it makes sense, whether it's, you know, exciting. But when it came time to judging the humanities ones, the scientists felt, well, I know, I read books, I can judge it, that's not any good. There's no teamwork in it, or there's not, you know, it's not cutting edge scholarship, or, you know, so that there was a way in which there are some individuals who do certain kinds of work who think because in their leisure they read books, right, or watch movies, mm-hmm. that they can therefore understand the disciplines of those who study and write about, analyze and write about books and movies. And, you know, they say, well, I watch TV shows, and so they'll read a proposal about someone who does, you know, mass media studies. Oh, well, that's not any good. It's not very, you know, I could have thought that myself. So there's a way I found that the humanists understand that the scientists have their own way of approaching the material and wouldn't have thought to say, no, I understand, you know, how, you know, I don't know.
Protease inhibitors.
Right. but it didn't work in reverse. And so often the humanities proposals were not accepted.
Really?
Because they didn't seem as scholarly as, because, well, I could do that myself, they would say. But they couldn't. They haven't been trained to do that. They don't know the areas. So that was a frustrating part, I have to say, of the cluster hires.
Judith, now that the subject of cluster hires has come up, I have to tell you, the subject comes up with some regularity in these interviews, mm-hmm. and I would say the majority opinion is not in favor of them, from what I have heard, that people feel it hasn't worked well. Can you comment on that?
I think there's some areas where it has worked very well. And one thing is it did get people thinking more about how can we connect various parts of the university. And it did pull us out of, you know, the silos that David Ward would talk about to a certain extent. Some of the clusters turned out just to be ways that people could increase the number of faculty in their programs. Some of the people, and actually it's interesting that some of this has happened in humanities and social studies areas, I don't know what's happened in the others, when they were hired into a department because they needed a tenure home, that tenure home did not value and give enough resources for the individual to do the cluster work. So, I mean, I can think of one in particular in one program where the cluster, where the person was supposed to have a joint appointment or but maybe had 100% tenure home, but was, and that tenure home wouldn't allow the individual to actually teach in the other program or wouldn't give them teaching credit for that. So they could do it as an overload. So there were times where it kind of backfired. But I do think that there have been some cluster hires that have, you know, I guess in the spirit of that conference that I had created, have gone ahead to create new fields to a certain extent. So I wouldn't say it's a disaster. I wouldn't say it's had no effect. I think it's had some positive effect, but I think when you look at most of the hires, they've just been absorbed into the university as regular hires. And to the extent that they do cluster work, it's the way I do interdisciplinary work. It's over and above my the expectations that I would ordinarily have.
Is that a program that's still ongoing, or has it ended?
There are no more clusters being hired. You know, there are no more searches for clusters right now. But there are certainly people here who are still on clusters and understand their work as clusters. There is, at some point, there was some funds put aside to sort of administer some of these clusters, because departments have resources. If there's a new program that's being created, where are those resources going to come from? Do you need a staff person sometimes? You need, so there is that, those funds, I believe, still do exist. And when individuals leave who had been hired on a cluster, that money goes back to the cluster fund.
Oh, it does.
So I think it does.
Home.
I don't think so. Actually, I don't know enough about this, so I really shouldn't talk too much about it. But there is still, I mean, I know still for questions of startup and, you know, recruitment, for taking leave, there are the cluster hires are still treated differently than the regular hires. So the problem is, it turned out to be, I'm not sure that everyone who got into it, that there was money put in from foundation, money put in from WARF, money put in from the state. I'm not sure that each of those parties understood that those faculty then are here for their careers. So it wasn't just an initial input of money. They have salaries that need to be paid year after year, and salary increases year after year. Which makes there be, you know, and one third of them were supported by WARF. That means that there are sort of professors walking around on campus who are funded by WARF and funded by foundation. That's a very different model, and it involves continuing funds, and so and it's become a very complicated accounting issue that I actually don't know enough about to talk about more, but it is still very present in people's minds. So that was one answer. Another answer to whether it's been a success or not, in many ways it brought a fair amount of attention to UW-Madison nationally.
Oh.
And that we were able to sort of tout it as this new approach. And we were last year, I think it was, or maybe even 2 years ago now, time goes rather quickly, asked to participate in a project that was coming out of University of Minnesota on interdisciplinarity. And everybody in that project knew about the cluster hires and knew about, and Madison was understood to be a place that was sort of at the front lines of interdisciplinary work. And that's valuable in and of itself, since interdisciplinarity has become such a buzzword. So that was a, you know, even if not all pieces of the experiment actually have worked out, that we did the experiment and that some of them have worked out have given, those things have given UW-Madison a PR push, I guess.
Judith, the issue of humanities came up in your response here, and I want to pursue that a little bit with you, if you're willing. Because I certainly, again, hear from some, not all, faculty in the humanities, speaking broadly, feeling somewhat defensive about the place of humanities on campus.
If I can make a suggestion, why don't we talk quickly about my graduate students? Because I think it's probably better for me to frame that in terms of my work as becoming the Associate Dean for Arts and Humanities. So,
Okay. Very good. So let's move on to your graduate students.
I'm not going to talk of each of them individually. I'm not sure if that's what you want me to do.
Well, I do want you to identify any that are particularly significant for what they did and where they are now.
Okay. And that's one reason why I probably won't talk about each of them individually, because of the role that I began to play in the department. So I'll talk about that. I was actually, I think only a second year junior faculty member, asked to advise a graduate student that I probably knew at the time, but certainly picked up very quickly, was someone who no one else wanted to supervise.
Uh-huh.
And I said, fine. And he was writing in an area, he was Korean, international student, writing in an area that I really didn't know that much about, but I supervised him. He got his degree and went back to Korea and is teaching in Korea now, mm-hmm. has been in contact a little bit. But I haven't kept up with the scholarship because it's all in Korean. He was not the strongest of our students whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I realize now that I should have been able to say, no, it's not appropriate for me to supervise this individual. I'm just a junior faculty member. It's not in my area. But I didn't know I could say no. So I would say that's probably the only time. There are only two ways in which I felt sort of taken advantage of as a junior faculty in my department. That was one of them. Sang-guk was his name. I then became in the department, and maybe I was in some sense hired for this, a kind of general hitter. What's the term in baseball?
Clean up hitter.
Yeah, but not just cleaning up, but just that I was a generalist and could work and would work with anyone. And the graduate students saw this also. And a number of them, I was the second reader on many, many dissertations of people who went on to have really lovely careers. But I wasn't their primary advisor, and that's why. And that had to do with them wanting to choose sort of, I was younger, I was female, and to choose the big name in the field to be their advisor. But they came to me often. That big name in the field often wasn't around, wasn't that communicative, didn't give much feedback. And so I did a lot of work with a lot of the graduate students in our department because I was the one with my door open. I was accessible. Again, I was female. I understood myself to be a mentor in all senses of the word. So I was the second reader, sometimes the third reader on many, many of our students who are at Ohio State, Wellesley, Notre Dame, Reed College, Holy Cross, Williams College. Mm-hmm. A lot of sort of top-tier liberal arts colleges, mm-hmm. As well as some research universities. And so I sort of started to see that was my role in the department, was actually to nurture them through, but I didn't end up to be the one with the sort of hotshot students. And I ended up having a number, and I realized this later, a number of women students who were very, very good, who were my advisees, who did not go on in the field.
Huh.
So I've thought about that quite a bit. What is it that drew them to me? Part of it was I was willing to work with people even if it wasn't exactly my research area. Because it was interesting for me. I learned new things, and we're a small department, and I figured people needed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they saw me as, again, nurturing, and they also, I think many of them went into graduate school assuming they would go on in the field, and people would come to me and say, how do you do it? You have children, you have a career, how do you do it all? And my only answer is, well, you don't do anything all that well. You just kind of do it. you always feel like you're never fully doing anything, but you just do it. We had a student, a terrific brilliant woman who, again, I was on her committee, but I wasn't her main advisor, who came in to me at one point and she said, when would be a good time to have a child? And I said to her, there's never a good time to have a child, so you just have it when you have it. You know, because she was meaning, while I'm still in graduate school, should I wait till I'm an assistant professor? Should I wait till tenure? And I just said, you just do it. Well, 3 months later, she called to say she was pregnant with twins. I said, no, that's a bad idea no matter what you do. She now has 5 boys and is a tenured professor and is still brilliant and wonderful. But in the sense that was, you know, that became my role. I also had another male who was brilliant wrote a wonderful dissertation, and he was on the market for a year, and it's a very small field, and it was a particularly bad year, and he ultimately said, you know, I can't stand the financial uncertainty of it, and he also left the field. So, mm-hmm. You know, I have wondered, what is it about me, because I'm known to be a, you know, major scholar in the field, that attracts the people who don't necessarily go on to be the major scholars themselves. But they go on to have wonderful lives, and all of them have said how important it is that they got their PhD in Russian literature, and that how important that they worked with me. Actually, one of the individuals now is working in the graduate school.
Oh.
So that's a sort of an interesting story about my students.
Yeah, it is very interesting. You know, I've heard very little about the process of graduate students getting their PhD.
Mm-hmm.
I think, in fact, you are the first, I think, to talk about being reader, being second, being third on mm-hmm. the committee,
mm-hmm.
nurturing.
Yeah.
But that happens in every department.
Yes, and actually part of my job here now in the graduate school as the Associate Dean for Graduate Education is thinking about that advising process and how it works and how to best facilitate it. So we can talk about that more when we talk about my current position.
So do you think that your behavior with reference to graduate students was driven primarily by your gender or by another orientation?
I think partly by my gender, so I can't say primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And I also can't say how much my gender affected some of these other things.
Uh-huh.
So, for instance, I worked in my office in the department all the time, whereas a lot of my male colleagues worked at home in their offices. Problem is, when I was at home, there was the laundry and the kids and the, you know, somehow this sense of myself as being the mother. Even if the kids were at school, there was still, you know, I have to make the doctor's appointment, I've got it, whatever it was.
Right.
So that for me, I worked better when I was in the department, even though I would have, and I always kept my door open. So even though I would have interruptions, it was still easier for me to work and feel professional there than it was at home. And that wasn't the case with a lot of the other professors. And so I think I was just available for students. But it was also, I think, my understanding of what my role was or is,
mm-hmm.
Which has a lot to do with mentoring and whether that mentoring is... I think the traditional male model of a professor, the role is to find the brilliant student and replicate yourself in that student and send that student on to a job like yours. Well, I have always understood that there are very few jobs like mine, and there were which meant that at most I could, you know, replicate myself once. But in fact, I'm still in my job, so even if I replicated myself, that person wouldn't get my job. So that there was some other reason why I was teaching graduate students, part of it was to help them bring out what was their contribution to the world and to scholarship, and maybe it would end up to be in academics and maybe it wouldn't, but that my role was to help them flourish. And I know that not all faculty have that same understanding of their role. Although they tend to understand it more for graduate students than for undergraduate students. But even for graduate students, not everyone has that. And so I think that people in my department saw that. Some of it also has to do with partly why I went into service and where we're going to move, because I had my eyes open, and I quickly got to know sort of the way the university works, and the way the department works, the way the college works, the way the graduates, you know, whatever it was, I became sort of an expert in the workings of the department. So, I mean, it frustrated me many times because they would, you know, a student would have another advisor and go to the advisor and say, well, what am I supposed to do for to set up my prelim or to set up my defense? And the person would say, go ask Judith. So I was, in fact, doing that kind of on-the-ground advising for everyone else's students. But the truth was I did know. And now the other faculty member could have found out but hadn't bothered to. So there was a time, actually, there was a time when I was having, I was probably chair at the time, and I was having to fill a committee. And I asked one of my colleagues, you know, could you do this? And the colleague said, no, I couldn't possibly do that. I need to be in the library. And I stepped back and thought, well, what does he think, where does he think I need to be? You know, I need to do my scholarship and everything also, but I also recognize the importance of doing this other work for other people. And so that, I did have some frustrating times with that. And then the colleagues who purposefully show themselves to be incompetent so that then they're not asked anymore to do service. There are certainly some of those in my department as well as elsewhere. And the students, I quickly saw that I was someone that they could come to and rely on. Even if I didn't know the answer, I would know where to ask, where to call, or I would make a call for them to find out. Because I knew how frustrating and anxiety-provoking it is to be trying to get your defense done and or, you know, figure out what's, you know, what's in the prelims. There was this sort of mysterious, you know, non-transparent world where you're just supposed to know how you're supposed to study for these things. And I thought it was important actually to that they could learn more if we helped relieve that anxiety by being transparent. And so they saw me working for those things, and I think that attracted them. So is that only gender? No. But some of it is related to gender for sure.
One more question about your role with the graduate students. Did you ever encounter in your position students who were doing work that really intrigued you?
Definitely. I mean, I...
And that expanded your horizons?
Absolutely. I think I talked about this way back when I had a professor who really gave me the sense that every time I walked into a classroom, he had something to learn. And I've always thought about that. And again, sort of having your eyes open. If your eyes are open, you can learn a lot from these students, graduates and undergraduates. But certainly there have been graduate students who have written on areas that have just expanded my knowledge of philosophy or literary theory, in ways that I wouldn't have been able to have if I hadn't encountered them. So it's that's definitely exciting.
All right. Judith, I want to ask you to turn your attention now to your career as in service to the university, and that seems to be equally substantial and distinguished. So we might as well start having you talk about when you first stuck your toe into service and what that was like.
I think this it relates to sort of having my eyes open on on campus, because very early I became involved as an assistant professor in a number of programs, certainly in the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia, because I was interested in interdisciplinary work.
Right.
And so I was on the administrative council for that, and because of that met people in other departments. I also, while still a junior faculty member, Center for Jewish Studies was just beginning to come together with George Mossy and Lane Marks, Ken Sachs. Mm-hmm. And I was actually at that time the only assistant professor who was on the sort of involved in the discussions of how should this center be formed. Mm-hmm. And that was very exciting. And so I, again, it was another way that took me out of my department and met with other people. And I just felt that it was important to have these kinds of interdisciplinary centers. I thought that Jewish studies was an important area to have on campus. Discussions that we had about the separation of church and state and how this wasn't a study, it wasn't a study of religion. Although since then, of course, I became very involved in the religious studies, the revival of the religious studies program. And I think where we've been able to show that you can study religion without it be, without there being any compromise of the division between church and state. And so those, I think those forays into committees outside of my department showed me the larger university, and that was a very interesting place. I also, I think in my second year here, became an advisor in the Faculty Advising Service of Letters and Science. At that time, they had faculty, they didn't have the, cross-campus or cross-college advising service mm-hmm. then, sort of professional counsel, advisors. And so we were trained, and once a week I went in and for 3 hours saw students from across the college to advise them on what their basic requirements were, gen ed and breath requirements, and then once they declared a major, they would have an advisor in their own department. Mm-hmm. So that also allowed me to learn a lot about the department. Well,
were you doing anything with women's studies?
I did. Yes, I also was doing work. Some work with women's studies, although I did not do that much administrative work with them. I have done a lot of administrative work with the Center for Rush East Europe and Central Asia, CRECA, with Jewish studies and religious studies are probably the largest places where I've put my time. And, your time gets splintered between all of these different, because each of them has to have different committees on them, and mm-hmm. so if I wanted to be part of it, I had to also be on committees in these various different programs. Unbeknownst to me, at least in this particular way, I'll tell the story of Tino Baglio. A year, maybe two, after I got tenure, I became chair of the department. And the year before then, David Bethay had said, let me see if I can't create an associate chair position to sort of groom you for it, to let you know. And he was able to create that. And so we have an official associate chair in our department, even though we're a fairly small department, quite small department. It turns out that I was at a chair's reception or something a couple of years after, and Tino Baglio says, I see your chair now. You're the one who, in the tenure file, it was said, and she will become chair of our department one day. And so what that told me is that they had sort of been seeing me already as a junior faculty member as someone who could be chair. And I hadn't really, although I'd been involved in all sorts of workings of the department, I guess kind of, I thought that that's what everyone was supposed to do and what everyone did. And then I started to see, oh no, not everyone does it. And not everyone can do it. There really is it is a skill. And I, when I was first chair, there's a way of getting swallowed up in being chair of your department. Mm-hmm. And someone gave me the advice that was very good, and I followed it for about a year, of keeping in my assignment notebook what I did that day, meaning I returned this phone call, I spoke with this student, I called this administrator, all of those things, because at the end of the day, usually as chair, you feel like you haven't done anything. Why was I so busy all day? What did I do? Because we're not trained to understand those administrative tasks as actually being valued, being worthwhile. And in fact, they're very worthwhile, but there's a very easy tendency to you know, say, I didn't teach a class, I didn't write an article, I didn't read a book, what did I do all day? And so I learned to value the work that I did do. And so I never felt, I felt burdened sometimes as chair, but I never felt resentful. And there are faculty on campus who do feel like, oh, it's taking me away from my real work. Mm-hmm. And I started to realize, and this is another thing I've advised people on also, that often when you're a faculty member and you have to go to a meeting, you feel like it's taking you away from your work. Mm-hmm. And what I began to realize is, no, that is my work. And to value that work that I was doing. And that was a very important cognitive shift, I think, that helped me and helped me see that there were things about administration that I enjoyed, even though there are some very frustrating things. And even though there is a kind of... a way in which, you know, being chair is looked at. I did have friends who said, oh, you're going to have to be chair, or they're making you be chair again. Can't you get out of it? You know, mm-hmm. Oh, I would never agree to be chair. And I thought that was a mistake, I wasn't only doing it because it was required of me. Once I started to do it, I made a commitment to find out what's valuable in this. How is it important? And it's very important. And it's very important for helping people. And I guess I mean, I don't want to sound too sappy on this, but I get pleasure from helping people. Uh-huh. Now, I also get pleasure from writing articles and reading books and teaching classes. And all of those things have to be curtailed when you do administrative work. Mm. But I found it very important to keep doing those along with the administrative work. I haven't traded one for the other. I haven't wanted to be a full-time administrator. I wanted to make sure that I teach every year, make sure that I have graduate students, make sure that I, you know, I'm on the, you know, board, or I was, I'm off, but the board of directors of my major scholarly organization, made sure that I, you know, went to conferences, gave papers, that I was still invited to give talks. All of those things are still really important to me, but I like the administrative piece too.
Does that mean that you, if pressed, would say that your work in administration, small a, is as significant as your work, say, as a teacher, small t, scholar, small s?
Yes. I think so.
Interesting. I don't hear that much.
Yeah, I think it's not just that someone has to do it. I think that you can do it poorly and not help people as much, or you can try and do it well and make people's experiences in this world of academia better, mm-hmm. fuller, richer. I see that as my role.
Mm-hmm. Now, according to your resume, you are chair the first time 1995-96. Mm-hmm. Are you chair just for a year?
I 95-96. See, because I took a sabbatical in 97-8, so maybe I haven't the wrong. It is possible that I chair. It's also out of order here. spring, 95. So what did I do 96, 97? This is a very good question. Well, I turned out not to be, I was on the Academic Planning Council in the graduate school because I was, no, I think I must have been chair also. It must have been 90, I was associate chair 96 through 97. Oh, I know what it was. Okay, sorry. My mistake. I did become chair that year because I think it was Gary Rosenschild who had been chair, and then he took a sabbatical. So I filled in for him for that year, and then he came back for a year,
okay.
Is what happened. And then I was going to be the next chair. I took a sabbatical and then came back in 98, 99, and I was going to be chair for three years then. So I would have done that. You're right. I'd done that first year, and then I came back and was going to be chair for my sabbatical. But it was then I came back, and it was that the end of that summer, the summer of 98, that I was asked to be interim associate dean for at that time it was just called humanities mm-hmm. in the graduate school. And I said, I'm already supposed to be chair of my department. And they said, well, you can do both. And I'm thinking, but I said, I guess I should tell you the whole story of how that happened.
Yes.
Okay, so I came back. I actually had, in 97, I had cancer. And so that kind of messed up my sabbatical a little bit, but...
A bit of an understatement.
But I still went in the spring semester. We went to Israel with my family, and that's when I was able to research that book. When I came back, and I took up the chairmanship in the summer, and had great plans for how I was going to, you know, help the department and change it in ways that were going to be important. And at the end of the summer, I get a phone call from Martin Cadwalader, who at the time was associate dean for social studies. And I knew him because I'd been on the graduate faculty executive committee as a faculty member for the graduate school. And that was an eye-opening experience for me. I remember at one point turning to the woman who was sitting next to me and say, well, where are you from? She said, I'm from the School of Nursing. And I thought to myself, I didn't even know we had a School of Nursing. So you really met people from all over the university, much broader than my work in the college before. And you started to see how the medical school works and the School of Engineering and how different they are, School of Business, and how different in what different ways they bring in graduate students and how they deal with them. So I was on the Graduate Faculty Executive Committee, so I knew Martin, and I get a phone call, and he tells me that Fanny Lemoine, who was the previous Associate Dean for Humanities, had died.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had heard that actually the day before, and I said, oh, thank you very much for telling me. You know, it's a very sad passing, and, you know, I liked her very much, and she was very important, and he continued to talk about it. And I thought, well, isn't this nice? He's calling all the chairs of humanities departments. And only after a while did it dawn on me that he was actually asking me if I would serve as interim associate dean. And it dawned on me, and I said to him, you know, Martin, I'm clearly too stupid for that job because I didn't even understand that's what you were asking me. And I said, I need some time to think about it. And I spent a week really just not sure what to do because, first of all, I had been sick.
Uh-huh.
I had two children still in school. One of them was just starting first grade. And I was chair of my department. And yet, it was a wonderful honor and a wonderful challenge. And I like learning things, and I knew I would learn a lot. And I think I lost like 5 pounds that week because I just was so agitated trying to think and talk to everybody. And it was my brother who said, you know, you don't know when things are going to come around. So you have to take them when they come. Because you might say, oh, this is sort of like me and the baby. And it was, you know, he said, you know, maybe you say to yourself, well, 5 years from now, you know, I want to finish this book and finish my term as chair. That will, you know, then I'd be ready. But the opportunity might not turn up then. So he says, you might as well try it. And I don't always think his advice was good, but I took that advice. And I came back to Martin and I said, because he said, you know, tell me as soon as you can because we'll need to move on to someone else if you don't want to. And it was getting near the beginning of the semester and they needed someone in the position. And I came back and I said, you know, I talked to Virginia Hinshaw, who was the dean at the time, and who I also knew because I had been on this graduate faculty, grad fac. And I said, I would like to do it, but you need to know that I have other loyalties. I still have primary responsibility in my department. I have responsibility for my family. I have religious commitments. I mean, on Friday afternoon, I'm going to have to leave, and there are going to be Jewish holidays, and I'm going to have to be gone. And he said, if we can't accommodate those things, then what good are we? And I thought that was a very wise thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they should be able to accommodate families and professional work and religious commitments. I mean, mm-hmm. that... And so I held him to that over time. but he's always been very good about it. And so I said, yes. But at the same time, I said, I'm doing it for 1 year. And I want to keep my professor identity as my primary identity. You know, Fanny had sort of moved everything into her office here in the graduate school. It was up on the third floor then. Oh. And she would see her graduate students here. And I said, no, this will be my graduate school office. I want to keep my other email. I want that email to be for my other life, my graduate school email just for graduate school work. I'll come here in the afternoons. The graduate school at that time, still ostensibly it's true, but at that time it was really quite established that the associate deans, the academic associate deans, came in the afternoons, and we were all here in the afternoons, and we all worked very closely together, consulting with each other, working with each other, and we always knew, and the rest of the staff knew that we would be there in the afternoons.
Every afternoon?
Every afternoon. It was a 50% appointment at that time. And, you know, I mean, we had vacations or we had conferences to go to and things. But
the theory was
we were there, and therefore people would know, you know, in the morning, you know, the grad ed staff or the accounting staff or whatever would do the work that they needed to do. And when we came in, it would be on our chairs or on our desk waiting mm-hmm. for us. And they knew that we would be there. They could come up in the afternoons and consult with us if there was a student issue or a research issue or whatever it was. And we worked very well together. That has kind of fallen apart a little bit. People have different schedules. And I think for the most part, you know, for the most part, the idea is it's still that, but you can't always count on seeing your colleagues in the afternoon. So that was a very good thing, and it really created a good bond between us. And what I discovered over the course of that year is that I really enjoyed the work, that it was exciting. I enjoyed meeting and getting to know all of the humanities faculty on campus, the new faculty coming in, finding out about the students and the different programs in the humanities and how they worked. And also, and this is going to get back to something you'd asked before, being an advocate for the arts and humanities on campus. And that
did
I realized
you have
how important.
The arts? As well as
well
humanities.
Yes, I always did, and actually one of my innovations was to add the word to the title, because people in the arts department, and we have quite a few of them. I mean, we have a very large art department. The practicing musicians in the music department, there are many more of them than there are the humanities scholars in the music mm-hmm. department. Dance, theater, and drama in the School of Human Ecology, there are artists. And that they needed to know that this was an appropriate place for them to come also. So I made a campaign to add art to that. And now both in the college, they've added art also. They had in the divisional committee. So now it's sort of, I'm always very careful to say arts and humanities together. The other campaign that I realized I had to wage was with the use of the term research. Because I actually had never thought of myself as a researcher. I thought of myself as a scholar. And research seemed to me to be what they did in a laboratory. And I realized that that was true of many of my colleagues. Although we clearly do research in a broad sense of the word, we understood ourselves to be scholars. And the artists in particular didn't really see themselves as researchers. Mm-hmm. And so when they came into the research competition, the fall competition every year, they were finding, especially the artists, but even the humanities scholars sometimes too, that they were having to contort their narratives in a way to make it sound like it was research. And some, you know, especially junior faculty would sort of create projects that sounded like research, whereas in fact, if they had simply talked about their own project in their own terms, it would have been a perfectly appropriate thing to fund. But when they tried to make it quantitative or I'm not thinking of good examples now. It became contorted in a way that it wasn't a good proposal. And so what I was quite successful in doing, I think, although there's still pockets, was having people talk more about research, scholarship, and creative activities to encompass the work that all of our faculty do on campus and not use the term that really for most people seemed like that was science. I found that I faced this in many ways. So university communications would come up often to the grad school and say, can you give us some stories, some things to write about, you know, cutting edge research. And I realized it was partly my responsibility to teach them that scholars in the humanities who might be studying, ancient Roman calligraphy, right? Mm-hmm. That to the public is not going to seem like cutting edge research. That's not the only kind of scholarship that there is. Yeah, cutting edge research might find a cure for cancer, right? Might use fetal stem cells, mm-hmm. Might be some new area called, fancy, sexy area called nanotechnology mm-hmm. or something. Those are the things that the public easily recognizes as research. But there's other work that scholars do that is equally important, but different. Mm-hmm. And that you need to learn that how to, university communications needed to learn to talk about that as equally exciting. And so I saw that as part of my responsibility. At first, actually, it went in a slightly different way. At first, I realized when I came up here that I had a huge vocabulary that I needed to learn. I needed to learn how the biological sciences work and how they talk about it and what they don't talk about advisors as much as they talk about trainers. Well, trainers is not a term that anyone in my field would ever have used. I don't see myself as training my graduate students, mm-hmm. mentoring, advising. And they do use those also in those, but there was a vocabulary of research that I needed to learn. After about a year on the job, I realized actually it wasn't only that. It was that I needed to teach them my vocabulary. And this goes back a little bit to what I talked about, the cluster hires and being mm-hmm. on that committee. And so I saw that as a very important mission.
Were you well received?
I think I was well received. I think some of it is because I did have a scholarly profile that people knew about. Mm-hmm. And some of it had to do, again, going back to the same reason why I was well received in my department by graduate students, is because I my door was open and I returned phone calls quickly, and I tried, even if I didn't know the answer, I saw my role as facilitating the work of whoever was calling me up, a faculty member saying, I don't know what to do, I'm submitting this NEH proposal, and I blah, 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 and I saw my job as helping that person, okay. and people like people who help them generally.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I realized I got pleasure from it. It wasn't taking away from me, it was feeding me. So I think I was well received, and I certainly was incorporated very easily, I felt, into the world in the graduate school itself. And we have we still have a terrific staff in the graduate school. I remember many years before I came to the graduate school, David Bethay saying to me, I think you'll go ahead and be dean sometime. He says, but more a dean like in the graduate school than in LNS. And I thought, I wonder why he said that. But once I got here, I realized that it was really a great place, that just it worked. It was a place where you could more say yes more often than no, whereas in the dean's office in letters and science. That's changed a little bit. We have to say no a lot now. But certainly at that time, it was a place where you could give money and advice to people and not just say, no, you can't have that, no, you can't do that. And so it's rewarding in that way.
Did you control a budget?
No. And that was a question when I came up here. I said, how do I know how much money I can offer to this or that? I don't have a checkbook. I don't know what the... And my closest mentor was Martin Cadwalader. And that it made sense because the humanities and the social studies work together, and the biological and physical sciences had always worked together. Mm-hmm. And so I was in his office all the time, and one of the marvelous really extraordinary things about Martin is that whenever I went into his office, and I learned that it was true of whenever anyone went into his office, he made me feel like that me and my question was the most important thing he had to do all day long. And it was, I'm not always able to replicate that, but I valued it from the very moment that I saw it, that he would talk to me, whatever question I had, whatever issue that I had, he would focus on that, and no matter how busy I knew he was, because I was also an associate dean, I knew how busy I was, mm-hmm. but he would just give me that time and that attention, and that's a marvelous thing.
Mm-hmm. This was on budget.
On budget. So I said to him, how do I know how, you know, if someone says, I need this, there are certain things that are set when we go into the research competition, how much total there is to give away, but there were other, you know, out of season requests, and he said, just go on precedent. If you think it's the right thing to do, and it's been done before, well, feel free to, you know, give that funding. And it was frustrating to me because I didn't know what I was dealing with. But at that, when I first came to the graduate school, it wasn't true, but the perception was that we had unlimited money that we can give out. What mm-hmm. became pretty clear is that we were going into debt. so we had to create mechanisms where we would share with each other what we were doing. Let me tell you, we weren't going into debt because of the money that was spent on the arts and humanities.
I'm sure.
But,
I believe you.
But it's all one thing, and we have to work together as a group. And so we created mechanisms over the coming years about how we would, you know, bring, you know, either big ticket items that people had requested to an associate dean's meeting where we would work together, or, you know, different things changed. You know, recruitment and retention became a very big money issue in mm-hmm. the graduate school, just because there was just a great need. Someone mm-hmm. needed to be paying it, and no one could. And that was one of the reasons why we probably spent more than we should have. I was always an advocate for the grad ed side of the graduate school. Mm-hmm. And so I was always one in there saying, you know, we need to give, you know, this amount to fellowships. We need to make sure that we reserve this for whatever. But not that the others weren't. The other associate deans also had as the part of their mission graduate education, but when someone comes along and needs to buy $1 million microscope, I felt my role is always saying, yes, I understand the importance of that microscope, and we're probably going to go ahead and give $1 million for this out of $20 million. You know, that's 1/20 of the Wharf gift. Actually, $5,000 to give over in this area would make a huge difference. You know, so would you give, you know, why don't you think instead of $1 million, giving 900, you know,
95.
That would seem too petty. So they should give out. And I would say, but these smaller amounts and sometimes bigger amounts for people in the arts and humanities are equally important. And so I saw that as my role of or for graduate education I saw that as constantly important. And so back to an earlier question about how humanities faculty perceive themselves on campus. I think when I first started, there was really a sense of underclass citizenship and not getting funding. I think that has changed. At least that there isn't the same sense of underdog quality to it. There's a sense that everyone's underfunded. And I take some credit for giving a voice to the arts and humanities on campus. I mean, I was part of the development of the Center for the Humanities and raising the profile of both the arts and the humanities. And I feel proud of that. Mm-hmm. Not that there aren't individual pockets where people still feel like, all this building's going on for the sciences, what about us? Mm-hmm. There is still some of that. And there are a number of things that are inconsistent that I've faced that in the many remain inconsistent. So, for instance, fellowships in the physical or graduate assistantships, you know, RA-ships in the physical and biological sciences are given out for the on an annual basis, which means that those students are funded over the summer. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, fellowships have been in the arts and humanities and social sciences only 9-month fellowships. And then people turn around and say, well, why is the time to degree so long in the humanities? And I have to remind them, well, not only do these students need to go to, you know, Yugoslavia to learn Serbian in order to do their research, and then they needed to spend 3 years in archives somewhere gathering their research, but they also weren't paid over the summer to do their research, and so they were having to work in McDonald's at the same time. And of course that delays. And their, you know, TA ships are much lower paid than the RA ships that they might have had in the sciences. So I was having to explain that this is all part of a piece, and you can't say, oh, those humanities students, they take so long to finish. What are they doing contemplating their navels? I say that's just so wrong to see it that way. And part of the problem, in fact, is funding. And so, you know, I have argued that there should be funding for social studies and humanities students through the summer as well. It hasn't gone as far as I would like it to go. But there are, you know, there are biases. And, well, why were they, you know, I would say to the biological scientists, well, you know, why should your students be paid over the summer? Well, they need to be in the lab. And I'm thinking, well, our students need to be in the library. They need to be doing their research also, or their scholarship also. Mm-hmm. So there is a conflict of, historical reasons lie behind a lot of the things that we do, and then there is a conflict of cultures. And I saw my job as constantly mediating that conflict, learning about it, teaching people about how we operate and how we see the world in the arts and humanities. So
now, a couple of questions. That first year, when you are interim, mm-hmm. how do you solve the issue of still being a teacher and scholar mm-hmm. while you're up mm-hmm. here in Basque?
Well, it was very hard to deal with it. Okay. And the same way when, you know, people would ask me, how can you be, you know, a wife and a mother and still do all of this stuff? And I said, you just do it and you never feel like you're doing anything as well as you could. I did not teach that year, and I missed it. I definitely missed it. And I probably did not begin as many of the things that I wanted to do for changes in the department as I would have.
Were you still chair then?
I was still chair then. Now, that was very hard in terms of time. My husband was also going back to school that year. You know, one child was in fifth grade, another had started first grade, and for some ridiculous reason we decided to get a dog. So it was a really hard year.
Yeah, I think that is ridiculous. Nothing personal.
No, I don't know what came over us. We had told the kids when we went away, you know, that when we come back we can get a dog, because we, you know, when we take them away from their friends and their home and whatever, we go abroad. And my husband had always said, when you stop acting like dogs, we'll be able to get a dog. And so he would say, oh, I still see a little tail there. I still see a little bit of floppy ears. Finally he said, you know, I want a dog. But that aside, I was very organized. I did my work there, you know, in the Slavic department in the morning, in the graduate school in the afternoon. I tried not to combine them. I mean, when I first started, I didn't check my other email. When I was here in the grad school, I only checked my graduate school email. When I was there in the morning, I would only check my, WISC mail account or whatever it was called mm-hmm. way back then. That changed over time, and it would turn out that there were things that I needed to know were coming up in the afternoon, so I needed to check my email in the morning. And then people started sending me they didn't know which email they were sending it to, and I would have to trade back and forth. So it became messier. But certainly when I started, I was very organized about doing my work. And I still had students writing dissertations, and I think I actually even had an undergraduate who was working on an honors thesis with me that year. And And I had researched this book that
right,
I wanted to keep working. No, this was the book on the doubly chosen, right, the converted, right. And I had sort of written up sort of the skeleton of it over the summer but I didn't want to lose momentum on that. And so I just kept working and working and working. I did one thing that was difficult, and this gets back to gender, but not only gender, that I came, there were three other associate deans, all male, mm-hmm. all somewhat older, more established, mm-hmm. and all with spouses who worked at the UW. And it would get to be 5 or 5:30 or sometimes 6 o'clock, and I would say, I've got to go. I've got a family that I have to get home to, and they had grown kids. They didn't have kids at home, and their wives were also working late on campus, and so they, you know, it could be 6:30, 7 o'clock, and so I started to feel like it was always me who was saying, well, I've got to break this up. I've got to go home now, and that was, especially the first year or two, was. For some reason, it was difficult until I started to, first of all, I started to work later also. And when I didn't, I knew it was my right to get up and go. And that's where I would hold Martin to it and say, remember when I said that my first priority lies with my family and my department, and I've got to do that. And they always said, fine, no problem. But I felt funny leaving. And I felt, here's the little woman getting up to leave, mm-hmm. and the men are staying to do the real work. Mm-hmm. So I think it was my problem. But I did feel it those first couple years. And I think maybe it was my first or second graduate faculty executive committee meeting when I was an associate dean already. And they met from 3 to 5 on Fridays. And by November, by 5 o'clock, by 4 o'clock, it's already dark and I need to get home for the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting up and leaving and feeling bad about it. And I talked to Martin about it the next week. He said, you should never feel bad about that. We should feel bad that we've made the meeting from 3 to 5 on a Friday afternoon. And then for many years I said, no, it's, you know, I'll just leave early on the days that I need to and it'll be understood. But a couple years ago we moved to meeting from 1 to 3 on Fridays. And he had been pushing for it a long time. He says, we should accommodate you in this. And I said, well, I'm just one person, and mm-hmm. but we now meet from 1 to 3.
Oh, good. Now you took the interim position as for one year. Where along the line does that end?
Well, in the first semester I realized that I was gonna need to decide whether I would continue in that position, or if I wanted to continue in that position. I was going to have to decide during the first semester before I had really done all that much, because timetable for the next year had to be created and mm-hmm. Other, you know, issues. But I knew I was enjoying it. And so by winter break, January, I think I probably told. And again, Martin was usually my contact. He was the senior associate dean. We can talk about Virginia Hinshaw a bit. Not only was he my sort of professional, you know, I saw him as my supervisor somehow, but also as my colleague and my confidant. And so I talked these things over with him. And, you know, I said, I think I'm enjoying this. I think I can make a difference. And so there was a search. There needs to be a search for this position. I think in terms of governance, there needs to be a search regardless, although that isn't how the associate deans had always been named in the graduate school. But oh. I said, I think it makes more, it's fairer and correct to do it that way. And also it will give me legitimacy if I turn out to be the one who's chosen. And so there was a search, and I was chosen. and I said, but I can't remain as chair. And I felt very guilty toward my department, very, very guilty. Because it's a small department. And, you know, let's say if in any department there are 10% of the people who really can do administrative mm-hmm. work, and that's probably an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. In a department of 10, That makes one person. So I've always stayed very active, very involved in my department. The past couple years, I have just pulled back. I got tired of them saying, well, I don't know, go ask Judith, when all they needed to do was open up the internet and find out, you know, who do you call for this, or who do you, you know, they could have, there's a chair's manual, the chair would come to me constantly. The office staff was all, partly because I tended to work in my office, was always coming to me, and the graduate students were coming to me, and so I've definitely done my best to pull back from that, because I just can't do everything. I'm getting older. I've got other things. Mm-hmm. So, but it was really in the middle of that year that I thought I would like to continue to do this.
By summer of 99, then, mm-hmm. you have the position.
I have the permanent, or as permanent as these positions are. It turned out to be more permanent than I thought.
But it is still 50%.
It is still 50%.
In name only, I assume.
Yeah. Well, no, 50%, but 50% of what? So if you understand your work week to be 100 hours, mm-hmm. then that's 50 hours, right? Okay. Because I was still trying to do and was doing, not as well as I wanted to, but doing all of my work as a professor. And one of the odd things about being a professor 50% is all that really means is 50% teaching load. But all of the other things you do as a professor, research, students, national responsibilities, you know, refereeing articles for journals, that continued at 100%. Mm-hmm. You know, I did learn to say no a little bit more often. I can't, you know, be a reader for that book. But a lot of times, I mean, I was interested in it, so I would still say yes. You know, I thought I could learn something. I was a reader on a dissertation. Actually, we were co-advisors on a reader of someone writing a dissertation in Israel, and I knew that I really was the person who should be advising him on this, and so I took that on, and it broadened my perspective also. So I didn't say no to as many things as I probably should have. I have spent 10 years being very tired, but I've also spent 10 years, more than 10 years, learning huge amounts of things and meeting lots of people and doing lots of things. So I wouldn't give it up for anything, but it is indeed, I mean, you can't get around it. It's hard to do so much and so much different. I would walk from Van Hise over here and my head was still filled with whatever that was, and I would have to work hard to sort of clear that out so that by the time I came here, I could focus on graduate school things. And that's very hard. You're just constantly interrupted by one thing or the other.
So if you ruled the world, would you make this 100% position?
No. And this position I'm in now, and we'll talk about how I got to this position, is 75%. But at my insistence, that I think it's very important to keep a hand in to both for my for how I'm perceived and for my own fulfillment, to keep a hand in as a professor and to keep doing those things. I know the 50% position for the associate deans, the divisional associate deans, is very important, both because to keep your research profile going, both for how you feel about yourself as a scholar, and also how other people perceive you. Because if you're, you know, the chair of the research committee and you're judging their scholarship, essentially, and they don't think that you're an active scholar who's keeping up in the field, they're going to say, well, wait a minute, you know, who the heck are you to think, you know, to make judgment over what kind of retention package I should get or whether I should have this, you know, out of season, you know, request denied, you know. So that I know the graduate school has always placed a premium on keeping up the research profiles of the divisional associate deans. So I was able to have a project assistant most years to help with my research going. And I think faculty also, in general, not just for the research area, but view you in a particular way if you're faculty. Now, what I've discovered is the minute you come here, you're already they somehow. You're already the administration. And the longer you're here, the weaker the ties get to being we with the faculty. But I've worked on that quite consciously. And when faculty come up here to discuss something, a new program or a difficult student or whatever it is, I often say, well, in my program, this is how I do it. Or when I was faced with that with a student, this, and when students come too, I'll often give analogies from my own experiences. And I think that's quite important. So I would not want this to be 100%. However, there's certainly enough work to do for full time.
So do you essentially endorse the structure that is here now?
I do. I think it's worked well. Mm-hmm. There are, I'm going to wait to get into that.
Know a lot.
Yeah.
So, Judith, I want to continue with the graduate school, and there are a number of areas to pursue. First, let me confirm that when you're here, both as interim and then permanent associate dean for the Arts and Humanities, Ginger Henshaw is dean of the graduate school.
That is correct.
And how does that work? What is your perspective on her and her initiatives here?
Well, I first got to know her before I was up here, and I remember, because I was on the graduate faculty executive committee, and I remember, again, it was David Bethay saying, what do you think of Ginger Henshaw? And I had been on the grad fac for a year when Chuck Reed was interim dean, and he was a very much of a sort of caretaker interim dean, and then mm-hmm. he, of course, became dean of the School of Ed. And when Ginger came on, she was full of initiatives and full of new things and energy, and she really saw herself as a doer. And so I said that to Martin. I think there'll be a lot of new initiatives. She did say something, and again, this was before I was associate dean, that I've always remembered and felt strongly about, and that was that if there is, oh, now I'm forgetting the words. If we've been asked to do something simply because we've been asked to do it, well, there's a word for that, and I'm not a good morning, maybe because I'm fasting.
I'm sure that's it.
You don't have to put that in the final transcript. That if it's simply because it's a mandate to do it, but that we don't in the graduate school see how it actually is furthering our mission, we should just do it to the minimum. We should do it, but we don't need to kill ourselves about it. We should save our energies for the things that we know are furthering the mission for the graduate school. And there are a number of things like that with system and forms we need to fill out. And I think it makes a lot of sense that we need to know what our priorities are and not simply be doing a lot of work for what other people's priorities are. We do need to do that work. We need to fulfill our obligations, but we can save our, we should know enough of what our priorities are to save our energy for that. So that, I thought that was wise. What was she like to work with? Well, as I said, the associate deans bonded very well. Mm-hmm. And she was very energetic. But sometimes erratic. And so we, I think, the four of us saw our role as sort of keeping the ship steady. Mm-hmm. And there was some conflict. She came in from the biological sciences, and there was some conflict between her and the associate dean for biological sciences at that time, because it wasn't so clear what she wanted to do herself in the biological sciences. And it was also just personality things there. She was not that easy to work for, I guess I should say straight out. And I felt a particular pressure as the Associate Dean for Arts and Humanities because she really did not understand them at all. The UW Press is one of the centers from the graduate school, and when she took it on and she's trying to understand, well, what is this thing? You know, it's not even our faculty who are publishing at it. It's other people's faculty. And, you know, she did not know how scholarly publishing worked. And so she would make some decisions about where resources should go without seeing things as a biological scientist and not seeing things as through the not having as broad a mind as I thought that she needed to have. I invited her to a conference on campus that I was participating in, and she actually went to the keynote speech, which was on a Friday night that I couldn't go to, with one or two of the other associate deans. And I thought she would want to see how conferences work in this area that she was responsible for. And I think she went partly out of loyalty to me, not out of her own curiosity. Mm-hmm. And she came back just filled with, you know, he just stood up there and read his speech. It was so boring. And, you know, because in her field, they show slides and they talk extemporaneously, and they have teams who are working on it. Well, that's how we do conferences in my field. That's how we do keynote speeches in my, you know, some people do it better than others, and this person might not have been doing it particularly well. Mm-hmm. But her reaction was a condemnation of the whole way that humanities works. And that, I found that to be very frustrating. And she would often say things that I thought were not helpful and were very hurtful sometimes for the humanities. And I would go in there and I would confront her, and I always felt myself a little bit childish sort of going in there. And I didn't like that about myself. And she would push back and push back. And then later she wouldn't apologize. She would say, well, I was doing that because I just wanted to test the level of your commitment to this particular item. And that just is not the way that I work. I try to see things from my interlocutor's, you know, point of view and bring us into dialogue, and that wasn't her mode at all.
Was she predisposed against the humanities?
I think that she simply didn't know them and didn't understand their value.
Okay.
I started feeling very petty about it, like thinking about the things that she chose to put up on her wall. You know, I'm thinking, we've got some world-class artists at this university. There are some really major pieces of art that you could, you know, put up, and that wasn't her perspective. Mm-hmm. And so I did not enjoy working with her very much. She did, however, have energy, and that was really important. She didn't do that much to bring in, and one of the ideas that she had was this Wisconsin Distinguished Graduate Fellowship that I want to talk about it for a little bit, which mm-hmm. was a very good idea, because we had always been told in our programs and departments in the graduate school also that you couldn't really raise money for graduate education, that people, that alumni are only interested in their undergraduate programs. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one fallacy was that graduate students all went on to become academics, so they themselves didn't have money. But of course, only a small portion of them go on to become academics. Most of them, graduate students, go on to become other things altogether. I mean, there are lots of master's only programs, and they go on to become, you know, all sorts of things. Engineer, you know, PhDs in engineering go on to be CEOs of major companies. And so it's, you know, business. There are a lot of graduate students themselves, and there are also a lot of faculty who are interested in giving to graduate education because they know how important it is. So in the graduate school, we always knew that it wasn't correct that people wouldn't give for graduate education, but that was, I think you probably can confirm from the foundation's point of view, the ruling myth.
Yes.
Ginger worked out that WAR funds could be used to match or actually supplement the funds that were, you know, developed mm-hmm. through the foundation, and that could bring in more donors. And it certainly did. Mm-hmm. But there were certain things that were not thought through adequately. So, for instance, she had thought that that Worf's agreement to supplement the funds was on top of the regular gift to the graduate school. But what became pretty clear is Worf had agreed to it so easily because they said, well, fine, you can just, you know, whatever you're using for fellowships now in the graduate school, just move over into that program. But we had understood it to be on top of additional fellowships and not to replace the ones that we had, because the ones that we had are distributed campus-wide. There's a different model now, actually, in biological sciences, but we'll leave that aside for now. But distributed on a competitive basis, regardless of discipline. There are some, you know, I mean, that's very broad strokes. And what happened once you had these, if you were going to have the Worf funds only support those, you would lose, you know, when was, you know, Afro-American studies ever going to get one? Or when was, you know, East Asian Lang and Lit going to get a fellowship to be able to recruit a graduate student to their mm-hmm. program? They were all going to go to business, engineering, and then there were big chunks of them that went, you know, like to music. But the ones that went to music all went to music performance. Well, the music performance students hadn't been put up for fellowships before. So what happened to all of the students in, you know, ethnomusicology or in, you know, history, you know, So they were all designated for particular places, and therefore you were giving fellowships in the areas that the donors wanted and not in the areas that the academic mission needed it and right. that the students deserved it.
Yeah.
And that hadn't been thought through. Now, it would have been okay if these were, it still wouldn't have been okay because it still would have been uneven, but if these were equally spread through, you know, if they were equally spread through campus, which they weren't, because you can't have that's not what donors want to do. And if they were on top of the regular Worf gift, but because we had to make room for them within the Worf gift, it restricted us greatly.
Is that where it came down, that it did have to come out of
yes,
the Worf gift?
Yes, there was no additional money for it. But it turned out to be wildly successful. So successful that we had to call it quits to it before we actually got to the full number that we had originally been looking for, because we simply couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. And it did bring in good students. I think on the surface it is a very good program. One of the things we learned is that people would give money for graduate education. As a matter of fact, they probably would have given the full amount of the fellowship. And that's what we're hoping for now. Without that, sure, it was an enticement. Everyone would rather give half than the whole if they could, or give two instead of one mm-hmm. if they could. But if they had been, you know, we had known how to approach them in the right way, they might have given that one anyway all out and not had to compromise on other areas. So in that sense, it was not a success. And then combine that with the market downturn. Mm-hmm. And so programs who had them would get upset because they couldn't actually they didn't have the full amount. They had to do it every other year instead of every year because it wasn't earning what it needed to. You know, the estimate was after 10 years, it would have earned enough to do the full. Well, it wasn't doing that. And so the Worf funds had to continue to be added to it longer than we had thought.
Oh.
And if you could only do it, give it out every other year instead of every year, then the donor sometimes became upset. It ended up having ramifications in many, many places. Mm-hmm. But we still have it, and we're still doing it, and it is very helpful in many, many areas. So I don't mm-hmm. want to. And one place, and this is similar to the cluster hire, or maybe even more, it was a very high profile initiative. And so people are still coming up to me at, you know, graduate conferences and things and saying, oh, you have that, you know, graduates distinguished, the Wisconsin Distinguished Graduate Fellowship Program. How's it going? I try not to say these negative parts. I only say the positive parts. But it turned out to be much more complicated than Ginger had thought through.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long was she dean here?
Um, Oh, you're asking very hard questions. 5 years?
Yes.
Because there was some discontent with her in other administrative units, and not only within our own unit. Martin, and I don't know if any of this came out in his interviews, but he really took the brunt of it because he was the senior associate dean. She relied on him for a lot, and David Ward relied on him. I mean, they were colleagues from a long time back. And then John also, who had hired Martin, mm-hmm. when John became, you know, as provost and then as chancellor, he was really the intermediary. And basically, he was the one keeping everything together. And so it was time to do her five-year review. And I hate to put this quite so bluntly, but I guess there were people who hoped that she would leave and get another job. And it was quite clear that she had wanted, she wanted to move up in administration. And there were several jobs that she tried for and didn't get.
Here at the university?
No, elsewhere. She had been interested in the chancellor's position here, but it became clear that she shouldn't apply for that. Or maybe even when the provost, I forget what it was, but there were enough people, and it was obvious to her that there were enough people who weren't in support of her. Mm-hmm. So Martin was sort of told in some ways to keep the ship together, and that maybe they would start on this five-year review of her, but instead of having to do a negative review, hopefully she would get a job somewhere else, and she did. Mm-hmm.
Martin told me none of that.
Yes, and that's why I was a little worried about that. And Martin is just about one of my most favorite people in the whole world. And I will talk about that when I talk about him as dean. Hear me getting hoarse. I don't know if it's an and or a but. He's very conservative and cautious and careful. Maybe careful, I should say, instead of cautious, and kind. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have said any of this. Mm-hmm. He had a very large burden on him at the time. And I remember advising him. I mean, he was always very open with me, and mm-hmm. And he would come to me also for some advice. And I remember saying, you have to protect yourself. I mean, you can't be, you know, she didn't like to go to the Dean's Council meetings, and so she would often send him to Dean's Council meetings. Oh. So even a year that he was on, he decided to take a sabbatical, which he hadn't had in a while, but take it a 50%, how would it work? Not take, take it a 50% sabbatical, no, 100% sabbatical for a semester, spread out over a whole year. So it would be 50% each year. So that would be his mornings. So instead of teaching and doing his professor job when he was associate dean, he would be doing his sabbatical work, but in the afternoons still come here and be dean, because he didn't feel that he thought it would be too disruptive if he gave up this position for a year. But he really wanted to do his research. And but she kept calling on him for things in the mornings, like Dean's Council. And so it kept interrupting his time there. And he didn't feel he could say no, because he knew he was has been asked to sort of keep the ship together. Mm-hmm. So it was, I can speak for him that it was a difficult time. And it was a difficult time for the rest of us as associate deans. And I felt I felt guilty, sort of, because we would, some of the staying late and talking together, you know, we would sort of gather in one of our offices, and, you know, mm-hmm. There would be only two or three chairs, and one would stand and one would sit on the ground, and we would talk sometimes about Ginger. And that wasn't that healthy. It's kind of triangulating. You know, we were able to form a bond, but we all felt that we had to sort of work against her or work around her somehow because we weren't able to get to make the decisions we needed to make straight out. And it didn't feel, for instance, it didn't feel safe. She had started associate dean's meetings every week, or maybe it was every other week. And John Wiley had not had them when he had been, just the associate deans would get together themselves and do some of their work. But what turned out is, and I apologize for being so negative, but I felt I was able to get a lot of work done during that time for the arts and humanities, but there was a lot of tension during that time. And she didn't really understand the budget, and so we were having, and yet she was, certain things were withheld from us. You know, we thought if it could just be transparent to us, we could help work this through, but, that hadn't been the budget used to be totally controlled by the dean and the associate dean for administration. So the divisional academic deans weren't so much a part of it. Martin has changed all that. So there wasn't transparency there, so we couldn't, it was almost like we had to do a job that we couldn't do because we didn't even know what cards were on the table. And I started to talk about, must have been brilliant, but it's gone.
Well, you were talking about it was unhealthy, the association.
Oh, yeah, to sort of triangulate. What happened with associate dean's meetings is it didn't feel safe to go in there with an idea to just bat around the table.
Because damning.
It just felt like you needed to come in and you had to know everything that you wanted to do and just, present it and stick firm. And we often would, in advance, consult with each other to make sure that we were all on the same page before we went in there, because Ginger would sometimes seize on one thing and seize on another. None of this takes away from her energy and her commitment. I mean, she was amazingly committed mm-hmm. to the university, to the graduate school. I just don't think she was the right person for the job. Mm-hmm. Wasn't the right personality. She didn't have the right interpersonal skills, and she didn't have the right mentality, in a way, for it. She didn't have a kind of an open-mindedness that I thought needed to be there. So, although I enjoyed my work, as I said, I kept, mm-hmm. It was a terrific job. Mm-hmm. That was a point of stress. Mm-hmm. So
let me just end this. This now concludes the July 30th, 2009 session with Judith Kornblatt.